From New York Public Radio, this is the podcast of On the Media. On the Media is produced by WNYC and heard across America on NPR stations. Visit onthemedia.org to find your local public radio station. This podcast is made possible by WNYC and its listeners. Please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org.
From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. On Wednesday, a reporter's emails confirmed that Karl Rove was the leaker who outed Valerie Plame as a CIA officer to Time magazine. By Friday, it was reported that Rove told investigators that he did tell two reporters about Plame, but that he was first informed of her identity by yet another reporter, columnist Bob Novak, who, we all know, leaked it to the world. The week's events rendered the usually phlegmatic White House press corps positively choleric, and it worked up a sweat with White House Press Secretary Scott McClellan.
Do you stand by your remarks from that podium or not?
And again, David, I'm well aware, like you, of what was previously said, and I will be glad to talk about it at the appropriate time. The appropriate time is when the investigation...
When it's appropriate, when it's inappropriate.
If you'll let me finish.
No, you're not finishing. You're not saying anything. You stood at that podium and said that Karl Rove was not involved, and now we find out that he spoke about that Joseph Wilson's wife. So don't you owe the American public a fuller explanation? Was he involved or was he not?
According to a CNN tally, reporters asked about Rove 61 times during two press briefings on Monday alone. McClellan stonewalled, but the Republican National Committee rode in with a list of talking points, mostly attacking the credibility of Joseph Wilson, Plame's husband, who had charged the White House with inflating the case for war in Iraq. RNC chief Ken Melman noted that Rove was simply, quote, discouraging a reporter from writing a false story based on a false premise, and accused the Democrats of, quote, blatant partisan political attacks. But as Melman thrust, the president parried when questioned Wednesday after a cabinet meeting, with Rove sitting just a few feet away.
Can I ask you if you have spoken with your deputy chief of staff, Karl Rove, about the Valerie Plame matter, and do you think he acted improperly in talking about it with reporters?
Mark, I have instructed every member of my staff to fully cooperate in this investigation. I also will not prejudge the investigation based on media reports.
On Wednesday, the president took cover, but his press secretary had nowhere to run, nowhere to hide.
We've been rounding around on this for a couple of days now. I don't have anything to add to what I've said the previous 2 days.
That's a different question, and it's not round and round.
No, you heard from the president earlier.
Nothing to do with the investigation, Scott, and you know it.
You heard from the president earlier today, and the president said he's not...
It's a dodge to my question. It has nothing to do with the investigation. Is it appropriate for a senior official to speak about a covert agent in any way, shape, or form without first finding out whether that person is working as a covert?
First of all, you're wrong. This is all relating to questions about an ongoing investigation, and I've been through this.
If I wanted to ask you about an ongoing investigation, I would ask you about the statute, and I'm not doing that.
I think we've exhausted the discussion on this the last couple of days.
Scratch the surface.
If the surface wasn't scratched, McClellan conceded that he was.
May not look like it, but there's a little flesh that's been taken out of me the last few days.
Not quite gallows laughter, because while it may be McClellan's flesh, it's Rove's blood in the water.
The Valerie Plame investigation may already have another victim, journalism itself. Amid the special prosecutor's investigation, American newspapers have felt a chill. Among them, the Cleveland Plain Dealer. Even before the jailing of Judith Miller and Time magazine's decision to cooperate with the grand jury, Plain Dealer editor Doug Clifton wrote a column containing the startling revelation that his newspaper is not disclosing certain explosive leaked material for fear of the legal consequences. This has been the subject of some hand-wringing in the New York Times and elsewhere, and some frayed nerves. Clifton joins me now from Cleveland. Doug, welcome to the show.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Doug, tell us first what you told your readers in that June 30th column.
The thrust of it was that the Judith Miller-Matthew Cooper affair was a travesty and that a chilling effect on the pursuit of news would follow almost certainly. And that, in fact, at my organization, we've looked hard at the publication of two stories that relied on material that was provided under circumstances that could be enormously troublesome. And I shared with readers something that we typically don't share, internal news decisions about running or not running with stories.
Now, you kind of buried the lead in your column. You were discussing the Miller and Cooper issue and Valerie Plame. And then only in the last couple of paragraphs did you actually disclose that you were withholding this material.
Well, let me just stop you there for a second, please. The word withholding first appeared in the New York Times in their headline. And I take issue with the use of the word. What happened is we, in the news division of the Plain Dealer, exercised editorial judgment, which is different than withholding. When Judith Miller was told by someone that Valerie Plame was a CIA operative married to Joseph Wilson, she elected not to write a story. Was she withholding or was she exercising judgment? That's what I think is getting lost in much of the discussion of my revelation about the editorial judgment on these two stories.
Do you think that this is a concrete example of the chilling effect at work, that your editorial judgment was based on the legal ramifications of quoting these illegally leaked sources in your paper?
Yes, indeed. That's why I chose to share that with my readers, to illustrate that this isn't an abstraction. This is a real issue, that it can have a chilling effect. Not always, because the facts in every case are different. In this case, yeah, I think it had a chilling effect.
Do you think, for example, 1 year ago, given the same situation, that you would have made the same editorial judgment that you've made in this case?
If it were more like 2 years ago, I don't think so. Although I think that the temperature began to change post 9/11. It was a palpable change in government's reaction to openness and, I think, pursuit of perceived violations of law or secrecy and the like.
Is there anything that could happen that would actually make you change your mind and do some reporting based on these documents, come what may?
Well, let me correct you there. We've done a good deal of reporting on one set of the documents because we use the documents as a kind of a roadmap, and we're able to, by conventional means, without hanging information exclusively on the document, report components of the story. It's only when the one and only source for the information is the document that you come face to face with the giant issue.
Now, you said in your column that the reporters would be willing to go to jail and that you would be willing to go to jail, but, quote, the newspaper isn't willing to go to jail.
Well, yeah, I was speaking rhetorically there.
Well, does this mean before you made your editorial decision that you ran this up the flagpole with your publisher and at Newhouse Newspapers, did they weigh in on this decision at all?
Not at all. Nor did the publisher. I kept the publisher apprised that we were exploring these things and kept them apprised of the potential ramifications. But I never had a straight-on conversation about should we or shouldn't we. That decision was made by me and by my managing editor, Tom O'Hara. But let me emphasize, I don't think that this is all so extraordinary. I mean, decisions of this species are made all the time in newspapers.
Well, yeah, Doug, I think the issue isn't whether decisions like this are made all the time. The issue is whether the Plain Dealer is exercising excess caution in this case because of Judith Miller's predicament right now.
And the answer to that is difficult for outsiders to make because outsiders don't have all of the facts.
Well, let me, as an outsider without benefit of all of the facts, ask you this question. The Plame leak triggered investigation mainly because it was such a blatant breach of an intelligence secret, a CIA officer's identity.
Right.
Most leaks may cause administrative reactions, but not certainly full-scale criminal investigations. No grand juries, no subpoenas of reporters, and therefore no criminal contempt exposure of the sort that landed Judy Miller behind bars.
Right.
So if there is a really rather remote chance of a reporter winding up in jail, isn't the Plain Dealer being too cautious at the expense of its public service mission?
No, because you're presuming a remote chance. I mean, it amazes to me that you can sit there and say what you just said. You haven't a clue as to what the facts are. And you're saying There was a remote chance. Au contraire. I presume that there was a much better than remote chance, which is what drove the decision.
You know, I was really just asking a question, not making an assertion. I know it sounded aggressive.
Listen, I've got a very thick skin. I've been in this business 35 years. I was the executive editor of the Miami Herald before I came here. So it galls me that a bunch of armchair people who haven't a clue are suggesting that I just rolled over. That pisses me off mightily.
Well, point taken, but it was also the absolutely logical consequence of you writing those two paragraphs at the end of your column.
That's like, right.
Oh, by the way, we're not reporting this for precisely this reason. That's bound to raise questions.
I thought, you know, people will understand the gravity of this issue, and this will be a good thing to do. I mean, the dumbest thing that I ever did was to put those two paragraphs in there.
Now I will make an assertion. You are so wrong about that. You're assuming that people are questioning your editorial chops or calling you a coward, and nobody's doing that.
No, what do you mean nobody's doing it? I've gotten 200 letters from all across the country saying precisely that. Coward. That's the word that's being used. Coward.
By journalists?
Yeah, journalists too. Lawyers from hell and gone. Editors who you'd think would know better are shooting from the hip as to was this the right or wrong thing to do.
Okay. Well, Doug, best of luck.
Well, thank you.
Doug Clifton is the editor of the Cleveland Plain Dealer in Cleveland, Ohio.
And now an update. Last year, chairman of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, Kenneth Tomlinson, hired a consultant to ferret out political bias in NPR and PBS programming. That consultant was hired without the knowledge of the CPB board, an unusual move now under investigation by the corporation's inspector general, Kenneth Cones. And this week, Cones also agreed to investigate the process by which CPB's new president, Patricia Harrison, was selected, an investigation prompted by charges of, that's right, political bias. Harrison is the former co-chair of the Republican National Committee, which makes you wonder if Section 396 Clause E, Part 2 of the Public Broadcasting Act has been violated. It states that no political test or qualification shall be used in selecting employees of the corporation. But if Chairman Tomlinson does find himself in hot water, it won't be for long. His term expires in September. The Washington Post reports that major Republican fundraiser and campaign donor Cheryl Halpern is next in line for the job. Coming up, the insurgents pick a mouthpiece.
This is On the Media from NPR. This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. Earlier this year, the governor of Washington State approved a new law that would hike gas taxes by 9.5 cents over the next 4 years. Last week, opponents handed in petitions with enough signatures to get an initiative on this November's ballot to eliminate that law. The petition drive owed its success in no small part to the efforts of two men, Kirby Wilbur and John Carlson, daytime hosts on a conservative Seattle talk radio station, KVI. For weeks, Wilbur and Carlson had railed against the new tax, directing listeners to a website where they could contribute money and volunteer to gather signatures. Political advocacy? Clearly. But could it also be considered a political campaign contribution? According to a local judge's ruling earlier this month, It certainly can. The ruling has attracted the attention and concern of media watchers around the country. Among those concerned is Bruce Johnson, a Seattle media lawyer. Bruce, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Can you explain what the judge's ruling said exactly?
Well, the judge determined that these two talk show hosts, by heavily promoting this particular anti-gas tax initiative, they were basically part and parcel of the campaign, and therefore their contributions should be treated as in-kind contributions and reported to the Public Disclosure Commission. Our Public Disclosure Commission law has an exemption for the news media, but by issuing the ruling, Judge Wickham essentially concluded that this was not news, feature, commentary, or editorial, but was part and parcel of promoting an election campaign.
The judge did say he wasn't restricting campaigning by any media outlet. He was merely requiring it to be disclosed to the general public. So is there any cause for alarm here?
The judge was applying a public disclosure law, which I think is fair and equal to all concerned. The problem arises when you start having limitations on the amount of contributions, and those limitations are then applied to the media.
So in certain political instances, there would be a limit on speech simply because there's a limit on the amount of your contribution if it's evaluated in dollars.
That's correct. The state regulators would essentially evaluate the cost of airtime on KVI or conceivably if the amount of editorial space in a particular newspaper and the like. And then at some point, it would be illegal to make any more editorializing in support of a particular candidate or in opposition to a candidate.
But to be fair, Carlson and Wilbur weren't simply editorializing in support of the measure, were they? They actually helped to organize the campaign to get it on the ballot. In fact, Kirby even bragged about having written the measure.
They were clearly advocating and pushing this initiative. There's no question about it.
Once upon a time, of course, in the days of the Founding Fathers, all media outlets were partisan operations. And I know you've said that since the Constitution was written when the press was so very partisan, there's no reason why these First Amendment rights can't be extended to these very partisan media operatives.
Let's be very frank about talk radio. The KVIs of the world are clearly the inheritors of a very partisan history of newspapering. The political parties have always been involved in supporting the news media to one degree or another, and it's only in recent generations that we've seen the concept of objective journalism.
But campaigns have changed enormously, too, from what they were in the days of the founding. Now, campaigns are floated on money to an extent they never have been before. They rely on huge corporate PACs or labor unions, and it's all about airtime. That's where that money goes. So the founding fathers may have been responding to talk radio-like reality back then, but they weren't coping with, some would say, a principle even more important to maintaining our democracy, fair elections.
Well, Thomas Jefferson's pocketbook may not be as big as the National Rifle Association's. I'll concede that. But the fact remains that with the internet, with bloggers, more and more voices are being heard than ever before. And I would argue that we're really not dealing with an area that is completely shaped exclusively by money and the big special interests.
I know you're a bit troubled by this decision, Bruce. You told the Olympian newspaper that first they come for the KVIs of the world, later on maybe they come for the Sulzbergers being the publishers of the New York Times.
I think that to the extent that you have campaign finance laws which restrict speech in any way, it is very hard to say, well, we'll restrict speech, but we're going to exempt the media. Two things result from that. One, the people who are subject to the restrictions simply turn into the media themselves. And back in 2004, the National Rifle Association decided it would become a member of the media, in part in reaction to the campaign finance decisions. Two, it's very difficult to distinguish who's a member of the media from who is not. Of course, the bloggers believe they're clearly members of the media, and yet they're not considered mainstream media by some folks. So it's very hard to determine how far these types of decisions will go once you restrict campaign speech of any sort.
Do you expect that with the combination of McCain-Feingold and the increasing fuzziness about who is and who isn't a journalist, we'll have more and more of these sorts of cases cropping up in other parts of the country?
I think it's as natural as the day follows the night. So it's a natural outgrowth of these so-called reforms. I think you're going to see more and more efforts on the part of partisan organizations and the like to basically end up owning the printing presses themselves so they can say, look, we're exempt from these types of laws under the First Amendment. The problem is, once you go down the avenue of campaign regulation, it's difficult for regulators to know where to stop.
All right. Thank you very much, Bruce.
Thank you.
Bruce Johnson is a partner in the Seattle law firm Davis, Wright, Tremaine. In Baghdad, suicide bombings are as common as they are tragic. But this week brought news of one especially horrible, an attack on a group gathered around a U.S. soldier reportedly handing out candy and toys. 27 people were killed, most of them children. 2 days later, coordinated car bombs killed some 26 Iraqis. Al-Qaeda in Iraq took credit for those bombings, at least some of them, but made a point of denying responsibility for Wednesday's attack. It was another reminder that the Hydra-headed monster referred to so often in the press as the insurgency is actually a disparate group of factions, each with its own goals and strategies. And with nobody officially speaking for the insurgents, we can't be certain who did what for what reason. But that may soon change, at least a little. On July 3rd, two Iraqi militant groups announced that they had appointed an official spokesman, Ibrahim Yusuf al-Shamari. The Islamic Army of Iraq and the Army of the Mujahideen said Shamari would speak for them. Baghdad correspondent Steve Negus covered the story for the Financial Times. He says there are a couple of reasons why the announcement came when it did.
The first is that some Sunni politicians had made statements saying they were putting forward demands that the insurgents thought were important, demands such as restoring the former army or reversing the debathification. Even though these Sunni politicians weren't claiming to speak in the name of the insurgents, they were using the insurgency as something of a lever to get attention for the agenda they were claiming to front. Presumably, one of the reasons Shamari is named is so that the insurgency could have a bit of control over the message that was going out. One of the other reasons is that the statement was preceded by reports in the press that there had been meetings between U.S. officials and the insurgents. One of the first things that Shamari said when he was named as spokesman is that there have been no meetings between the United States and between the insurgency. I would imagine that no branch of a very divided insurgency wants to be perceived as though it was speaking behind the back of the others and trying to cut private deals with the Americans. So that might also be one of the factors why this happened at this time.
What has he said? Has he offered any specific demands or clarified an agenda?
No, he has not clarified an agenda. However, he has said that he would welcome an official above-ground initiative from the U.S. Congress towards negotiations with the insurgents. The Americans are rather firm on the point that they do not speak to the insurgents because they don't want to undercut the standing of the Iraqi government. This almost seems like it might even be just sort of a ploy to sort of lure out official recognition of the insurgents from the Americans to make the Iraqi government look weak and illegitimate.
Has the Iraqi government had anything to say about Shamari himself?
Well, the spokesman said, you know, it would be nice to know who speaks for these guys. This government really doesn't know who's who in the Sunni areas, and the impression we have is that they're really trying to figure out who they can speak to. So I think in some ways, having a spokesman would be good from their perspective.
Shamari is supposedly representing just two groups, the Islamic Army of Iraq and the Army of the Mujahideen. Who are these guys?
Well, they are thought to be dominated by former members of the Ba'ath Party and former military officers. As often happens, these Ba'athist groups sort of take Islamic-sounding names. I mean, all the different groups sort of know each other, but the groups are individually quite diverse, and then panoply of all of them is also diverse. Presumably, this will encourage some of the other groups to put forward their spokesmen.
Up until now, Steve, how problematic has it been for you as a Baghdad correspondent not to have an official spokesperson to turn to? What have you done to get the insurgents' perspective?
There's very little you can do. I mean, what you're doing is you're going through intermediaries. You meet people who claim that they have insurgent contacts, for example, a tribal leader from an area where the insurgency is strong, or a religious leader, and he will say this is what they stand for. But, you know, that goes through a filter or two, and it's not the most reliable source of information.
So does the creation of a spokesperson like Shamari make your life a little easier?
Well, if it comes to a stage where I can contact him, you know, regularly, it would. But he hasn't made that many statements yet. He's had a couple of conversations with Al Jazeera. So he's not exactly very high profile just yet.
Would it be too much of a leap to suggest that the creation of Shamari's position might be a first step towards a permanent presence in the political arena by these groups? I'm thinking of parallels between what's happening now with the insurgency in Iraq and the history of groups like Sinn Féin or the PLO.
Yeah, that's the hope. But there are tremendous practical and logistical difficulties with actually setting it up, like, you know, having a host country which can do that without being accused of supporting terrorism, you know, of the insurgents themselves feeling secure enough that they can reveal a few names, particularly in Iraq. You know, if the government doesn't jail you, somebody whose family was killed by the insurgents might. And I think, you know, the security risk is a very big reason why the insurgents haven't gone public until now.
Is that the sound of prayer?
We're about to get the call to prayer.
Yeah. I was just wondering whether or not this appointment of this spokesman seems as an important event to you as it seemed to us here on the show. Suddenly a public face, someone to talk to, someone to hear from, the beginning of perhaps a negotiated future for Iraq.
Yeah, it was a breakthrough. It was a first of its kind event. The important thing is, you know, whether or not the insurgents can build on that. If they can make a spokesman who is accessible, you know, who can make substantive statements, who doesn't have to worry about, you know, getting killed if he says the wrong thing, and ultimately whether or not they can develop a single person into a political front. It is a first step to all those things, but we're still a ways away from having the real political institution which can pursue negotiated solutions.
Steve, thank you very much.
My pleasure.
Steve Negus is based in Baghdad for the Financial Times, but this week we caught him on the phone in Cairo.
The Time magazine cover story was called Inside the Mind of an Iraqi Suicide Bomber. A rare interview with a 20-year-old terrorist in training revealed chilling insight into the insurgency's deadliest weapon, but it also presumably served the interests of the insurgents themselves. Aparizm Ghosh wrote the story. He's a senior international correspondent for Time based in Baghdad. He joins us now from R&R in Singapore. His friends call him Bobby, and I will too. Bobby, welcome to OTM.
Thank you, Bob. Thanks for having me.
How did you find this young man, and how did you arrange this interview?
Well, like every other media outlet in Baghdad, we've been tracking the suicide bombing story for several months now. And like every other journalist there, we've been trying to understand what makes a suicide bomber tick, what their motivation is, how they go about their deadly business. And in the process of trying to find out, we put the word out among our contacts who in turn are connected to various insurgent groups. What we hadn't quite expected was that one of these groups would volunteer to send over one of their bombers on extremely short notice. And they did. They sent this young man who was a bomber in training. So we got it directly from the horse's mouth.
The man was photographed with his face masked, and he used a pseudonym. What else did you agree to get this interview?
The ground rules were quite simple. They would not tell us anything about where he was based, and he said he wouldn't give us his real name. His explanation was that he didn't want his family to be harassed at a later date after he had completed his mission. But he was quite candid and forthright in expressing his views. He told me a great deal about his childhood and about how he joined the jihad and what brought him to where he is today.
Now, obviously, this is a worthy story, and it was a very good story. But here's a guy telling you he will kill Americans and God knows how many Iraqi civilians. And when the interview ends, you watch him walk out of the room. Did that take any soul-searching on your part?
I mentioned somewhere in my story that it's not unusual for young Iraqis to be saying things like this, to be saying that they would like to join the jihad, that they would like to kill Americans and blow themselves up. And if I sort of called the authorities every time I heard a young Iraqi man say that, I'd be doing that five or six times a day. I had a hunch that this guy might be for real, but I couldn't be certain until several days afterwards. We needed to verify from several different sources. At the time he left us at the interview, I suppose we could have tried to follow him. It was a very public place where he met us. And if we did try to follow him, I would be putting the lives of my Iraqi staff at risk just in case we were caught. I made the call that we shouldn't do that.
Talking to the enemy itself is tricky business. I'm thinking, for instance, of the criticism CNN's Peter Arnett took in Iraq for, in effect, becoming a propaganda tool of Saddam's regime. Now, obviously, this guy's handlers would never have permitted him to speak with you if they didn't think that the interview would serve their purposes. Did you at any point feel manipulated?
No, I didn't. I think the story lays it out for what it is. I hope that the report serves as a cautionary tale for our readers. I think it comes from a tradition of being behind enemy lines and reporting from the trenches.
Did you work out any mechanisms so that if he does indeed go forward with his plans, as you wrote, to be ordered to climb into a bomb-laden vehicle or strap on an explosive-filled vest, that you'll be able to know what he has done when he's done it?
After the interview and after we had confirmed that he was who he claimed to be, we asked through our sources that we be told after the mission takes place. I have no way of knowing whether we will indeed be told. The groups that he associates with are not the most reliable people in terms of information. So I really couldn't say. My best guess is he's probably already dead by now. We met him 3.5 weeks ago, and he told us then that he was part of a group of 10 or 12 young men who had signed up at the same time for suicide missions. And of those 10 or 12 men, there were only two left alive, he and another friend. If I take him at his word, then I think he was very close to getting the final call when we met him, and it's quite possible that he's already dead.
Look, Bobby, I would have done this interview too, under probably exactly the same terms. But I want to know if, 3.5 weeks later, you are haunted by it, and how you will feel if you learn that indeed he has completed his mission and taken innocent lives.
I'm definitely haunted by it. How can a journalist not be? How can a human being not be? This is not the first time I've encountered a young man who wants to do something as terrible as this. I've met suicide bombers in training in Palestine. And even now, several years after that, I sometimes wonder. I can only go back to what I said at the beginning, which is that I think this was a valid exercise and a useful exercise, because understanding the motivation of a suicide bomber is a very important part of the war on terror, is a very important part of the world's understanding of the roots of terror and the nature of this terrible beast.
All right, Bobby. Well, thank you very much.
Thanks, Bob.
Aparizm Ghosh is a writer for Time magazine. He's based in Baghdad, and his piece was titled Inside the Mind of an Iraqi Suicide Bomber.
Coming up, how real-life lawyers can win over juries by being more like the lawyers on TV, and a novel approach to newspaper writing.
This is On the Media from NPR.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and the Kresge Foundation, building the capacity of nonprofit organizations through challenge grants since 1924, on the web at kresge.org. The Wallace Foundation, supporting ideas, sharing solutions, expanding opportunities, on the web at wallacefoundation.org. And the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, making grants to improve the health and healthcare of all Americans, on the web at rwjf.org. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. You know those legal notices in the back of the newspaper that, of course, you flip to first to find out about new parking regulations and changes in the recycling schedule? Oh, you don't devour those? Well, maybe you should.
Regrettably, your planet is one of those scheduled for demolition. The process will take slightly less than 2 of your Earth minutes. Thank you very much. There's no point in acting all surprised about it. All the planning charts and demolition orders have been on display at your local planning department in Alpha Centauri for 50 of your Earth years, so you've had plenty of time to lodge any formal complaints, and it's far too late to start making a fuss about it now.
Most legal notices aren't that critical. except, of course, to the newspapers who live off the ad revenue. Sasha Eisenberg recently wrote in Legal Affairs magazine about a struggle brewing over the local paper's gravy train.
Every state in the country has laws requiring counties, municipalities, and states themselves to inform citizens of pretty much the most mundane actions of government, from meetings of town and city councils to, in the piece I cite, an Ohio law that requires the government to, in two consecutive weeks, post in a general interest newspaper news of street sweeping. These are classified ads for government.
Virtually every state government is obliged to post these notices, but in a few states, New Jersey, Indiana, Colorado, and some other places, these laws are being challenged.
Yeah, there have been legislative efforts in a number of states that would free municipalities from having to buy these ads in newspapers and allowing them to post news of their doings on their own websites.
What's the argument against that?
The sophisticated argument against that from newspapers is one of transparency and that there's a responsiveness issue that governments need to spread news of what they're doing to citizens. The real reason that these laws aren't going anywhere is that the newspaper industry is lobbying to maintain a source of largely unregulated money. Unlike other forms of ad revenue, it tends not to go down during a recession. They tend not to have to compete with other newspapers for customers as readily because these are sort of cozy relationships that have existed for a while between newspapers and local governments.
At the dawn of news, as you lay out in your piece, all there were these government notices. Let's go through the history that you outline. You say that in England in the Middle Ages, the crown would dispatch heralds to read proclamations from the king at half a dozen sites around London. I guess that's the hear ye that we see in all the movies. But then around 1665, those proclamations started being published.
Right. You developed a slightly more literate reading public and the development of movable type and printing became the new alternative, and the early newspapers in London in the 17th century were published by the crown itself.
And what about in the 18th century and in America?
The Boston newspaper that came out in 1704 bore the words "published by authority" in the same place that the Times has all the news that's fit to print. And the point was is that these papers sought not only their funding, but their identity and credibility by the fact that they were government published. There wasn't the development of a private press until the time of the revolution.
A lot of things started happening after the revolution. Journalism tried to distance itself from government. What happened first?
Well, first you had the development of independent newspapers allied with political parties. They would get these ads and the money that came along with them because of their loyalty to the party that was in power. At the federal level, during the Lincoln administration, reformers killed basically federal publishing patronage. By creating the government printing office, which then printed its own information and news without having to buy space in papers. Local governments end up buying space in newspapers to announce decisions or actions that they're taking.
Sasha, do you ever read these notices yourself?
No.
What really bothers you about this is that taxpayers are paying for the placement of notices designed for them that they will actually never see.
Right. And the newspapers don't care whether anybody reads legal notices or not. There's no indication the government cares whether people read public notice. I mean, these are very much a legal fiction. It's what the law calls constructive notice, that government basically has created laws that say that if this is in the paper, we can assume that anybody who needs to read it has read it. This isn't about a right to know. This isn't really even about transparency other than in its most sort of mechanical, irresponsible form. And we see now that in many cases, op-ed pages are pushing government to use their websites for disclosure about campaign finance laws, about congressional trips. We see government websites as the place where governments can spread information for citizens. And in this case, they have the benefit of being archival. They're easily searchable, unlike, you know, pages of newsprint. But instead, you know, you have sort of governments and newspaper publishers in this ongoing racket to keep this news hidden away in the back of the paper where nobody will ever see it.
Sasha, thank you very much.
Thank you, Brooke.
Sasha Eisenberg is a writer at large for Philadelphia Magazine. His story, On Notice, is running in the current edition of Legal Affairs Magazine.
Thursday, the Los Angeles Times ran the final installment of a five-part series titled The Girl. In it, reporter Kurt Streeter chronicled the exploits of child boxer Sunisa Estrada, who was 10 years old when the reporting began. It's an extraordinary portrait of an intense child overcoming social pathologies, gender stereotypes, her own emotional problems, and opponents in the ring to win a dramatic rematch. But it's also an unusual piece of newspaper journalism because it is largely devoid of sourcing and attribution, at least in the main body of the text. Kurt Streeter is here to discuss his series. Kurt, welcome to OTM.
Thank you for having me.
Let's start with where this enterprise began. How did you find Sinisa?
Well, middle of 2002, I was covering transportation here for the LA Times. Even though I was covering a fairly bureaucratic beat, probably to keep myself sane, I was always looking for a good story to tell that wasn't necessarily transportation related, and that's what I was doing up in East LA. I wanted to just kind of chronicle a teenage boy going through training maybe for the Olympic trials. And I stumbled upon Sinisa Estrada, and I just was quite taken with her.
Yeah, you hit the mother lode, or more like the daughter lode, because the series actually follows her and her father, a guy who had been in some trouble with his fists.
Yeah, exactly. Joe Estrada's, you know, kind of a typical story in a way. The guy who was a gang leader, really, here in East L.A., and two-time felon. He was also a two-time junkie, heroin addict for the most part. But really, over the last several years, has really worked hard to try to put his life back together piece by piece. And the fact that he's heavily involved in his daughter's life, I think, has really helped him, and that's what the story shows.
It is a very dramatic narrative, and it's rendered in a most unusual way. One of the techniques you use is the reconstructed quotation, approximations of speech or interior monologue that you clearly were not present to witness and to write in your notes. You had a novel way of handling that.
Well, what we did was, in reconstructing scenes where I was not on hand, but where I'd have at least two sources verifying that something happened in a particular scene or helping me reconstruct a scene, if I used a quote during that scene in the story, it appears in italics. Instead of using quotation marks, that means then that the quotes where you do see quotes, you can be assured that I was there and that I witnessed people say what we're presenting in the paper.
The other thing in this piece, starkly different from most newspaper journalism, is the absence of the traditional attribution. I mean, you don't say, according to so-and-so, who was standing there at the time. You do something else. Tell me about that.
Yeah, I just basically avoided it in a lot of cases, not always. We wanted to make it read like a fine piece of nonfiction. So as much as possible, we kind of took out the rather clunky he said, she said types of attributions. We handled that through a series of footnotes that we put at the end of each part of the series, where we call them chapters, almost like an academic text in a way. The reader can, at the end of the story, look at each scene and see how it was reported, when I had the interviews that helped support that particular scene. They know that they're not reading a story out of the White House or a story out of City Hall, where traditional attribution is pretty much necessary. And I just feel that when you're really trying to write a piece that just carries the reader along, it's in the writer's best interest to try to be able to take out those kind of attributions. And I think the readers really appreciate that.
Now, we've seen some of this before in Bob Woodward's book excerpts in the Washington Post, for instance, but also notably 3 years ago in the LA Times with a series called Enrique's Journey.
And also, in that case, the brainchild of John Carroll, who's our editor-in-chief of the paper. Enrique's Journey was the model for our use of footnotes. The story of a young boy who travels from Central America to the States by train and by foot and donkey. That was, I think, a six-part series, and the footnotes were maybe even more detailed than the ones that I used. And I think it certainly pays to be as transparent as possible, you know, to lay all your cards out on the table. I think readers are interested in seeing how a reporter goes about his or her work. And it helps us because journalists are, in a lot of ways, not really thought too highly of in terms of truthfulness these days, unfortunately. And when you can really be open, I think that just helps our cause.
Well, the mechanism didn't do Enrique's Journey any harm. It won a Pulitzer Prize, and may you be so fortunate. You know, obviously, for many reasons, you can't do this kind of footnoting and attribution for regular daily journalism. I mean, it's impractical to footnote stories done on the run and on deadline. Do your colleagues, when they see what you've done here, kind of roll their eyes and say, okay, I sure wish I had the benefit of a separate box for attributions, but unfortunately, I've got to use all the clunky he said, she said.
I think that they understand, and I feel that, you know, maybe just in the future for big stories, It's not every day that you get a 5 or 6 part series. Maybe this will be something that's used just in the future for all these kind of big takeout stories. Perhaps in the future we'll see more use of the internet for coming up with ways to be transparent. You know, maybe it'll be links on every story where the readers then can go and see a blog from a reporter on how they did the story, or links to how to get government documents that pertain to the story. So maybe it's kind of opening up new ground.
Well, Kurt, thank you so much for joining us.
Well, I appreciate it, Bob. Take care.
Kurt Streeter is a reporter for the Los Angeles Times. His 5-part series, The Girl, can be located on latimes.com.
So in this case, one great newspaper has chosen to present reality in the form of fiction. Increasingly, we expect real life to deliver thrills, once the sole province of fiction, as in TV courtroom dramas torn from the headlines.
The highest moral law in our culture is thou shalt not kill. And where we live, killing in the name of God, country, or brother is still called murder.
But when real-life juries, bred on TV's Law and Order, take their places in the courtroom, their verdict on the experience is likely to be 2 thumbs down. What's a lawyer to do? Call script consultant Neil Howard. He's worked as a TV writer for shows like King of Queens, but for the last 3 years, he's applied his writing skills to the courtroom. Neil, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
So how did this marriage of your writing background and courtroom consulting begin?
I was watching the Bush-Gore election coverage, actually the struggles in the courtroom, and I was struck by the fact that these were supposed to be some of the best trial lawyers in the country that were presenting these cases. And I was just duly unimpressed from my perspective as a writer, a dramatist, somebody who spent a great deal of time in communications. Shortly thereafter, I happened to meet Andrew Sheldon, who is a well-respected, longtime trial consultant who happened to be working on the Birmingham church bombing case. He thought that the prosecutors on that case would welcome all the help that they could get, and they were very receptive, and we went to work.
So in that trial of Thomas Blanton for the 1963 church bombing, what were the compelling narrative elements that the prosecutors may not have seen, but you did?
In most of these civil rights trials, time is really the most difficult issue, the long passage of time. The sense of relevance and immediacy that is needed to heighten emotion in a courtroom is often lost. You're also dealing with very old evidence, missing evidence, testimony that's being read in transcript as opposed to live witnesses. The two things that you need to do in order to put the narrative in place is figure out how to tell the best story that you can tell given the evidence that you have. Then you can begin to actually craft rhetoric that can play out in a trial theme or over the course of an opening or a closing.
So you look for those clear illustrations.
You might come across a fact like the fact that the force of the blast was equivalent to roughly 20 sticks of dynamite. Well, that's a fact that you can lay out in front of the jury plainly like that. Or you can say, that really was 5 sticks per girl. That's what the defendants calculated it would take to kill each of those children, to destroy hope, to destroy a dream, to destroy a future.
And do you also look to create clear heroes and villains? It's not hard in that case, God knows.
Even in that case, it is difficult because the defendant that is sitting in the courtroom is now a senior citizen and looks like anybody's grandfather. So one of the narrative tricks is to take the audience back in time, the jury back in time, and recreate the scene so that the villain is there in a very palpable and threatening way.
Were there any trials in which finding the winning themes was a very difficult task? Can you give me an example of when you found it and you said, that's it?
In the Mississippi burning trial that just took place, where Edgar A. Killen was convicted of manslaughter, you're faced with a problem like the passage of time. How do you turn that into advantage? So something like no amount of time can forgive their crime, or that they counted on the passage of time to get away with their crime. Time becomes a getaway car. They counted on the existence of racism over the years that would get in the way of a vigorous prosecution of what they had done. Things like that.
You know, some people say that TV has shortened our attention spans, and others say that complicated movies show that audiences can follow a complex story if they're suitable drama. So in your experience, what kind of narrative structure moves juries most?
That really depends on the facts of the case. And then you can make a decision, well, does this need to be told in a traditional sense, starting at the beginning and working your way through the middle and up to the end? Or do you want to do something more along the lines of a Pulp Fiction or a Memento and work from the middle or work backwards or jump around? I think that that's something that attorneys may not necessarily have the training in that a writer would. Part of the mistake that people make is only assuming that jurors, who are really just a reflection of the viewing population of television and film, that the only reason that they're watching those dramas is because they're well written. People have an inherent interest in justice. Justice is something that we are very passionate about, as opposed to, let's say, the finer legal points of the case, which is where the attorneys often spend their time. What jurors are interested in is mostly the spirit of the law and that justice is done.
Aren't some juries so accustomed to courtroom dramas that they're also cynical about lawyers and their motivations and very attuned to real versus fake emotional appeals?
Absolutely. And I dare say that perhaps their cynicism might come more from media coverage of real-life trials than it does necessarily from the world of fiction. But nonetheless, yes, they are much more astute at detecting things that don't ring true or insincerity. That's the job of a good writer.
So you've spent time in Hollywood, you've spent time in the courtroom. How long before you start writing courtroom dramas based on cases where you've been a consultant?
I might write a script based on a writer-turned-trial consultant with some fictional cases, perhaps.
So who would you want to play you in the movie?
The script that I'm writing, actually, it's Al Pacino.
All right.
I would be absolutely thrilled if Paul Giamatti would also consider the part.
Neil Howard, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Neil Howard is a script writer and a trial consultant in Chicago.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Megan Ryan, Tony Field, Mike Volo, and Jamie York, and edited by Brooke. Dylan Keefe is our technical director and Jennifer Munson, our engineer. We had help from Andy Lancet, Simon Jones, Sarah Dalsimer, and Josh Nathan Kazis. Our webmaster is Amy Pearl.
Katya Rogers is our senior producer and John Keefe, our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. This is On the Media from WNYC. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, online at wtgrantfoundation.org. The Kauffman Foundation of Kansas City, the foundation of entrepreneurship, on the web at kauffman.org. And the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation. Support for On the Media comes from Hofstra University, which this November analyzes Bill Clinton's administration at the 11th of its presidential conferences. More details at hofstra.edu. And the Bidell Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.
Thanks for checking out this week's On the Media from WNYC, New York Public Radio. This podcast is made possible by WNYC and its listeners. Please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org. And thanks.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, the New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.